All too soon, he abandons faith, openness to reality, and lets his mind harden into doctrine. The discovery of the mystery, the wonder beyond all wonders, needs no belief, for we can only believe in what we have already known, preconceived, and imagined. But this is beyond any imagination. We have but to open the eyes of the mind wide enough, and the truth will out. 2. Pain and time. At times, almost all of us envy the animals. They suffer and die, but they do not seem to make a problem of it. Their lives seem to have so few complications. They eat when they are hungry and sleep when they are tired, and instinct, rather than anxiety, seems to govern their few preparations for the future. As far as we can judge, every animal is so busy with what he is doing at the moment that it never enters his head to ask whether life has a meaning or a future. For the animal, happiness consists in enjoying life in the immediate present, not in the assurance that there is a whole future of joys ahead of him. This is not just because the animal is a relatively insensitive clod. Often enough, his eyesight, his sense of hearing and smell, are far more acute than ours, and one can hardly doubt that he enjoys his food and sleep immensely. Despite his acute senses, he has, however, a somewhat insensitive brain. It is more specialized than ours, for which reason he is a creature of habit. He is unable to reason and make abstractions, and has extremely limited powers of memory and prediction. Unquestionably, the sensitive human brain adds immeasurably to the richness of life. Yet for this we pay dearly, because the increase in overall sensitivity makes us peculiarly vulnerable. One can be less vulnerable by becoming less sensitive, more of a stone and less of a man, and so less capable of enjoyment. Sensitivity requires a high degree of softness and fragility, eyeballs, eardrums, taste buds, and nerve ends, culminating in the highly delicate organism of the brain. These are not only soft and fragile, but also perishable. There seems to be no effective way of decreasing the delicacy and perishability of living tissue without also decreasing its vitality and sensitivity. If we are to have intense pleasures, we must also be liable to intense pains. The pleasure we love and the pain we hate, but it seems impossible to have the former without the latter. Indeed, it looks as if the two must, in some way, alternate, for continuous pleasure is a stimulus that must either pall or be increased, and the increase will either harden the sense buds with its friction or turn into pain. A consistent diet of rich food either destroys the appetite or makes one sick. To the degree, then, that life is found good, death must be proportionately evil. The more we are able to love another person and to enjoy his company, the greater must be our grief at his death, or in separation. The further the power of consciousness ventures out into experience, the more is the price it must pay for its knowledge. It is understandable that we should sometimes ask whether life has not gone too far in this direction, whether the game is worth the candle, and whether it might not be better to turn the course of evolution in the only other possible direction, backwards, to the relative peace of the animal, the vegetable, and the mineral. Something of this kind is often attempted. There is the woman who, having suffered some deep emotional injury in love or marriage, vows never to let another man play on her feelings, assuming the role of the hard and bitter spinster. Almost more common is the sensitive boy who learns in school to encrust himself for life in the shell of the tough guy attitude. As an adult, he plays, in self-defense, the role of the Philistine, to whom all intellectual and emotional culture is womanish and sissy. Carried to its final extreme, the logical end of this type of reaction to life is suicide. The hard-bitten kind of person is always, as it were, a partial suicide. Some of himself is already dead. If then we are to be fully human and fully alive and aware, it seems that we must be willing to suffer for our pleasures. Without such willingness, there can be no growth in the intensity of consciousness. Yet, generally speaking, we are not willing, and it may be thought strange to suppose that we can be. For nature in us so rebels against pain that the very notion of willingness to put up with it beyond a certain point may appear impossible and meaningless. Under these circumstances, the life that we live is a contradiction and a conflict. Because consciousness must involve both pleasure and pain, to strive for pleasure to the exclusion of pain is, in effect, to strive for the loss of consciousness. Because such a loss is, in principle, the same as death, this means that the more we struggle for life, as pleasure, the more we are actually killing what we love. Indeed, this is the common attitude of man to so much that he loves. For the greater part of human activity is designed to make permanent those experiences and joys which are only lovable because they are changing. Music is a delight because of its rhythm and flow. Yet the moment you arrest the flow and prolong a note or chord beyond its time, the rhythm is destroyed. Because life is, likewise, a flowing process. Change and death are its necessary parts. To work for their exclusion is to work against life. However, the simple experiencing of alternating pain and pleasure is by no means the heart of the human problem. The reason that we want life to mean something, that we seek God or eternal life, is not merely that we are trying to get away from an immediate experience of pain, nor is it for any such reason that we assume attitudes and roles as habits of perpetual self-defense. The real problem does not come from any momentary sensitivity to pain, but from our marvelous powers of memory and foresight. In short, from our consciousness of time. For the animal to be happy, it is enough that this moment be enjoyable. But man is hardly satisfied with this at all. He is much more concerned to have enjoyable memories and expectations, especially the latter. With these assured, he can put up with an extremely miserable present. Without this assurance, he can be extremely miserable in the midst of immediate physical pleasure. Here is a person who knows that in 2 weeks' time, he has to undergo a surgical operation. In the meantime, he is feeling no physical pain. He has plenty to eat. He is surrounded by friends and human affection. He is doing work that is normally of great interest to him. But his power to enjoy these things is taken away by constant dread. He is insensitive to the immediate realities around him. His mind is preoccupied with something that is not yet here. It is not as if he were thinking about it in a practical way, trying to decide whether he should have the operation or not, or making plans to take care of his family and his affairs if he should die. These decisions have already been made. Rather, he is thinking about the operation in an entirely futile way, which both ruins his present enjoyment of life and contributes nothing to the solution of any problem. But he cannot help himself. This is the typical human problem. The object of dread may not be an operation in the immediate future. It may be the problem of next month's rent, of a threatened war, or social disaster, of being able to save enough for old age, or of death at the last. This spoiler of the present may not even be a future dread. It may be something out of the past, some memory of an injury, some crime or indiscretion, which haunts the present with a sense of resentment or guilt. The power of memories and expectations is such that for most human beings, the past and the future are not as real, but more real than the present. The present cannot be lived happily unless the past has been cleared up, and the future is bright with promise. There can be no doubt that the power to remember and predict, to make an ordered sequence out of a helter-skelter chaos of disconnected moments, is a wonderful development of sensitivity. In a way, it is the achievement of the human brain, giving man the most extraordinary powers of survival and adaptation to life. But the way in which we generally use this power is apt to destroy all its advantages. For it is of little use to us to be able to remember and predict if it makes us unable to live fully in the present. What is the use of planning to be able to eat next week unless I can really enjoy the meals when they come? If I am so busy planning how to eat next week that I cannot fully enjoy what I am eating now, I will be in the same predicament when next week's meals become now. If my happiness at this moment consists largely in reviewing happy memories and expectations, I am but dimly aware of this present. I shall still be dimly aware of the present when the good things that I have been expecting come to pass, for I shall have formed the habit of looking behind and ahead, making it difficult for me to attend to the here and now. If, then, my awareness of the past and future makes me less aware of the present, I must begin to wonder whether I am actually living in the real world. After all, the future is quite meaningless and unimportant unless, sooner or later, it is going to become the present. Thus, to plan for a future which is not going to become present is hardly more absurd than to plan for a future which, when it comes to me, will find me absent, looking fixedly over its shoulder instead of into its face. This kind of living in the fantasy of expectation rather than the reality of the present is the special trouble of those businessmen who live entirely to make money. So many people of wealth understand much more about making and saving money than about using and enjoying it. They fail to live because they are always preparing to live. Instead of earning a living, they are mostly earning an earning, and thus, when the time comes to relax, they are unable to do so. Many a successful man is bored and miserable when he retires and returns to his work only to prevent a younger man from taking his place. From still another point of view, the way in which we use memory and prediction makes us less, rather than more, adaptable to life. If to enjoy even an enjoyable present, we must have the assurance of a happy future, we are crying for the moon. We have no such assurance. The best predictions are still matters of probability rather than certainty, and to the best of our knowledge, every one of us is going to suffer and die. If, then, we cannot live happily without an assured future, we are certainly not adapted to living in a finite world where, despite the best plans, accidents will happen, and where death comes at the end. This, then, is the human problem. There is a price to be paid for every increase in consciousness. We cannot be more sensitive to pleasure without being more sensitive to pain. By remembering the past, we can plan for the future, but the ability to plan for pleasure is offset by the ability to dread pain and to fear the unknown. Furthermore, the growth of an acute sense of the past and the future gives us a correspondingly dim sense of the present. In other words, we seem to reach a point where the advantages of being conscious are outweighed by its disadvantages, where extreme sensitivity makes us unadaptable. Under these circumstances, we feel in conflict with our own bodies and the world around them, and it is consoling to be able to think that in this contradictory world, we are but strangers and pilgrims. For if our desires are out of accord with anything that the finite world can offer, it might seem that our nature is not of this world, that our hearts are made not for the finite, but for infinity. The discontent of our souls would appear to be the sign and seal of their divinity. But does the desire for something prove that the thing exists? We know that it does not necessarily do so at all. It may be consoling to think that we are citizens of another world than this, and that after our exile upon earth we may return to the true home of our heart's desire. But if we are citizens of this world, and if there can be no final satisfaction of the soul's discontent, has not nature, in bringing forth man, made a serious mistake? For it would seem that in man, life is in hopeless conflict with itself. To be happy, we must have what we cannot have. In man, nature has conceived desires which it is impossible to satisfy. To drink more fully of the fountain of pleasure, it has brought forth capacities which make man the more susceptible to pain. It has given us the power to control the future, but a little, the price of which is the frustration of knowing that we must at last go down in defeat. If we find this absurd, this is only to say that nature has conceived intelligence in us to berate itself for absurdity. Consciousness seems to be nature's ingenious mode of self-torture. Of course, we do not want to think that this is true, but it would be easy to show that most reasoning to the contrary is but wishful thinking. Nature's method of putting off suicide so that the idiocy can continue. Reasoning, then, is not enough. We must go deeper. We must look into this life, this nature, which has become aware within us, and find out whether it is really in conflict with itself, whether it actually desires the security and the painlessness which its individual forms can never enjoy. 3. The Great Stream. We seem to be like flies caught in honey. Because life is sweet, we do not want to give it up, and yet the more we become involved in it, the more we are trapped, limited, and frustrated. We love it and hate it at the same time. We fall in love with people and possessions, only to be tortured by anxiety for them. The conflict is not only between ourselves and the surrounding universe, it is between ourselves and ourselves. For intractable nature is both around and within us. The exasperating life, which is at once lovable and perishable, pleasant and painful, a blessing and a curse, is also the life of our own bodies. It is as if we were divided into two parts. On the one hand, there is the conscious I, at once intrigued and baffled, the creature who is caught in the trap. On the other hand, there is me, and me is a part of nature, the wayward flesh, with all its concurrently beautiful and frustrating limitations. I fancies itself as a reasonable fellow and is forever criticizing me for its perversity, for having passions which get I into trouble, for being so easily subject to painful and irritating diseases, for having organs that wear out, and for having appetites which can never be satisfied, so designed that if you try to allay them finally and fully in one big bust, you get sick. Perhaps the most exasperating thing about me, about nature and the universe, is that it will never stay put. It is like a beautiful woman who will never be caught, and whose very flightiness is her charm. For the perishability and changefulness of the world is part and parcel of its liveliness and loveliness. This is why the poets are so often at their best when speaking of change, of the transitoriness of human life. The beauty of such poetry lies in something more than a note of nostalgia which brings a catch in the throat. Our revels now are ended. These are actors, as I foretold to you, were all spirits and are melted into air, into thin air. And, like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit, shall dissolve. And, like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. There is more in this beauty than the succession of melodious images, and the theme of dissolution does not simply borrow its splendor from the things dissolved. The truth is, rather, that the images, though beautiful in themselves, come to life in the act of vanishing. The poet takes away their static solidity and turns a beauty which would otherwise be only statuesque and architectural into music, which, no sooner than it sounded, dies away. The towers, palaces, and temples become vibrant and break from the excess of life within them. To be passing is to live. To remain and continue is to die. Unless a grain of corn fall into the ground and die, it remains alone. But if it dies, it brings forth much fruit. For the poets have seen the truth that life, change, movement, and insecurity are so many names for the same thing. Here, if anywhere, truth is beauty, for movement and rhythm are of the essence of all things lovable. In sculpture, architecture, and painting, the finished form stands still. But even so, the eye finds pleasure in the form only when it contains a certain lack of symmetry. When, frozen in stone as it may be, it looks as if it were in the midst of motion. Is it not, then, a strange inconsistency and an unnatural paradox that I resists change in me and in the surrounding universe? For change is not merely a force of destruction. Every form is really a pattern of movement, and every living thing is like the river, which, if it did not flow out, would never have been able to flow in. Life and death are not two opposed forces. They are simply two ways of looking at the same force. For the movement of change is as much the builder as the destroyer. The human body lives because it is a complex of motions, of circulation, respiration, and digestion. To resist change, to try to cling to life, is therefore like holding your breath. If you persist, you kill yourself. In thinking of ourselves as divided into I and me, we easily forget that consciousness also lives because it is moving. It is as much a part and product of the stream of change as the body and the whole natural world. If you look at it carefully, you will see that consciousness, the thing you call I, is really a stream of experiences, of sensations, thoughts, and feelings in constant motion. But because these experiences include memories, we have the impression that I is something solid and still, like a tablet upon which life is writing a record. Yet the tablet moves with the writing finger as the river flows along with the ripples, so that memory is like a record written on water, a record not of graven characters, but of waves stirred into motion by other waves, which are called sensations and facts. The difference between I and me is largely an illusion of memory. In truth, I is of the same nature as me. It is part of our whole being, just as the head is part of the body. But if this is not